Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, as U.S. bishops wrap up their General Assembly in Baltimore, we hear from the conference's new president about their action plan for the church in the U.S. Plus, the bishops issue a statement urging the U.S. government to pull troops out of Iraq quickly and in a responsible way. And facing the challenges of Christian-Muslim dialogue, the embassies of Australia and Indonesia to the Holy See host a conference to look at the issues. We speak to a representative of Indonesia's foreign ministry. U.S. bishops wrapped up their General Assembly in Baltimore, Maryland, Thursday, approving a wide-ranging plan of action for the church in the United States. The conference elected a new leadership, awarding its three-year presidency to Cardinal Francis George of Chicago to replace Spokane Bishop William Skillstad, whose term had expired. Well, among some of the other things accomplished, the bishops voted to restructure the conference's management and committees and approved a revised edition of their document on faith and politics, which aims to help Catholics become conscientious voters. Emer McCarthy asked Cardinal George how it felt to be the U.S. Bishops' Conference's new president.
Well, it was very gratifying. It was elected on the first ballot, and these are contentious times for the church in this country. So to have received the trust of so many of my brother bishops was very moving and very humbling for me. And I think that the conference is united, and I hope to continue to keep it united in the mission that Christ gave his church.
Your Eminence, when you say that these are very troubling times for the church in the United States, what exactly would you mean by this? What would you see as the main challenges that the church needs to address?
Well, the fallout from the sexual abuse crisis, most of what happened some decades ago, but its discovery was only a decade ago, and that continues to disrupt church life, even as it also strengthens it, in as much as we have to reach out to help victims and strengthen the protection of children. Those are good initiatives, but there's still a lot of acrimony, and that is situated also within the general acrimony in our society. You know, it's become very much more security conscious, and that has led to a lot of contention in ordinary living, besides the whole division in the country about the war in Iraq. So these are just disputatious moments, and the church is naturally affected by all of that, with our own problems as well. The conference last year, when it started its reorganizing, put together some of the challenges to the mission of the church that we're going to try to address in the next several years. And basically, they are challenges to a church in a society where religion is more suspect because of the terrorist attacks. And so we've tried to say, how do we respond now in such a way that we can strengthen the faith in these new circumstances?
Your election to this post as president of the United States Bishops' Conference comes at the beginning of your General Assembly, a General Assembly that is very timely. It's coming ahead of the next year's U.S. presidential elections, a General Assembly that has many issues on the agenda. Would you like to perhaps outline one or two of these issues which you hold particularly dear?
Well, the faithful citizenship document that we put out every 4 years before the general elections in the United States was passed. You mentioned about the challenge of helping Catholics to vote in a morally responsible way. And the document this time, I think, is extremely well done and got very broad support because it emphasizes formation of conscience and doesn't just set out in a rather objective fashion the demands of Catholic social teaching. So what we do is set that out, as we have in many different documents, but now we're saying, how, therefore, do you form your conscience in such a way that you can vote in a morally upright fashion? I think it's a very good document, and that's one of the things that I think is most important on our agenda. The other thing is the consequences of reorganizing the conference. I mentioned that we stepped back and said, what are our challenges in this new situation for the church in the United States? And then we reorganized the conference itself so it would be more mission-driven and a little less oriented towards providing the vast array of services that we had tried to put together over the last couple decades, really. Among those challenges to the mission, our concern for strengthening marriage and family life is one that we're going to begin making public. We've already been working on it. That's very important to me, but I think to all of us. You know that the social teaching of the church insists that it's the family that's the basic unit of society, even if in a republic like the United States it's the individual who's the basis of the social contract for our political life. But in our larger society, it isn't individuals. We're born into families, and if there isn't a family that is a school of love, an individual isn't a very good member of society as he or she grows up. So that pastoral initiative on marriage is something that will determine the reorganization of the conference itself. How do we address that? Along with the life and dignity of the human person, the concern for Sunday observance and forming our faith and sacramental practice, vocations to priestly ministry and religious life, and also the challenge of a very, very newly multicultural society in the United States. We've always been a nation of immigrants, but now we're a nation of immigrants in a new fashion again in the last 10 years, particularly immigrants from South America. So those are pastoral challenges that the conference is going to address, and it has done that by reorganizing itself during this session.
Your Eminence, would it be correct in stating that perhaps these steps, these new issues, looking at the issue of marriage, looking at the issue of a conference that is more bent, more focused on mission not only within the church, but also within lay participation of the church, are these steps that you are taking to try to restore faith among believers, faith and trust in the bishop's leadership?
I think so. Trust is something that erodes quickly and takes some time often to rebuild, and we are facing that. But I think what you said is good. It depends upon faith, the basic faith that Christ founded the church and wants to use her as his instrument for saving the world. And while there are many sinners in the church, and some of them are ordained priests and bishops, nonetheless, the church herself is holy because she's the body of Christ. People's faith in that particular article of faith has been somewhat shaken, and so we have to do what we can. But I think it's not so much a special program as it is just simply to be faithful ourselves to the mission that Christ gave the church and rely upon God's grace then to do the restoration of trust and the healing of hearts.
Cardinal Francis George of Chicago, Illinois, the new president of the U.S. Catholic Bishops' Conference. Meanwhile, the U.S. bishops were also looking at the situation in Iraq during their assembly. They issued a statement describing the state of affairs there as unacceptable and unsustainable, and urged Washington to pull out troops in a responsible way and as quickly as possible. Susie Hodges asked the chair of the Bishop's Committee on International Policy, Orlando Bishop Thomas Wensky, if he and his colleagues had any difficulty in arriving at a consensus on Iraq.
The statement that we issued under the name of the president of the conference, Bishop Skilstad, and affirmed by the bishops themselves, was a restatement of our past policy positions. And so I think the consensus has been there for quite a while. And in fact, before the war in Iraq, the United States bishops held basically the same position of the Holy See. And we urged our government not to invade Iraq and to exhaust other possibilities. And so the bishops of the United States, together with John Paul II, were highly skeptical of the rush to invade Iraq. And this statement doesn't go back over that argument of about going into war. It's more now looking at our responsibilities now that we are in the war. And for that reason, we call for a responsible transition. We've assumed some responsibilities for the Iraqi people. And so while we should leave as soon as possible, we should leave in a way that is responsible. In other words, that we do not leave a vacuum there that would result in further bloodshed or genocide. And so it's a very nuanced position that negotiates between the one extreme that we hear in our politics of about staying the course and the other extreme of cutting and running.
Yes, you in fact criticize both sides on this, this issue. And you say that the U.S. needs a new bipartisan approach to Iraq policy.
We see in Iraq, among the Iraqi politicians, kind of a stalemate there where the Iraqi elected officials or politicians are divided. And we see the same thing among our own government. And that partisanship is not helpful to arriving at a solution.
Are you optimistic, though, that such a bipartisan approach to Iraq policy will emerge?
Well, I think optimism is a secular value, but hope is a theological virtue. So while we might not be optimistic, we certainly are hopeful. And basically, I think in the Congress, we see both sides taking some stock over some of their previous positions, and hopefully they'll rise above the politics as usual, which uses different things or different issues to score points against each other. I think this is too important of an issue just to be used as a political football.
You said, in fact, that the church's goals for transition in Iraq are more modest now than they were 2 years ago. Why is that?
Well, because the situation has certainly deteriorated greatly. We have, for example, almost 4 million people displaced, 2 million that have left the country as refugees, and another 2 million that are internally displaced within Iraq. And that is creating a looming humanitarian disaster, so that the exit should look at how do we do the least amount of harm.
Talking about the refugee crisis, the U.S., along with most other Western countries, have taken in relatively few numbers of Iraqi refugees. Do you think that there is a moral argument for all these countries, but particularly perhaps the countries that are in on the U.S. Military campaign in Iraq, to be more generous?
Oh, of course. And of course, you know, the first solution for poor refugees is that they be able to return home. But it really does not look like that's going to be a viable possibility for many of the refugees, especially those that have left because of persecution, because of religious reasons, or because of their association, sometimes very tenuous associations with the American troops, that they were working as translators or as cooks or in other types of positions. And because of that, their lives were threatened and they felt the need to flee the country. But countries like the United States, countries like Canada, Australia, have greater capacity than they have been allocating for the reception of refugees. And so we would hope that these nations would accept greater numbers of refugees. And in fact, here in the United States, we do have thriving Chaldean communities, Chaldean Christian communities from Iraq that are located in the Detroit area and also in the San Diego area. And many of these people who have already settled in the United States have relatives in these refugee camps, and a policy that would allow these people to reunite with their families would certainly be humanitarian. And again, because of the family connections, those relocations would certainly be more easy to achieve than in other ways, because they would have a built-in support system.
The bishops in their document also called for collaboration with Syria and Iran over the Iraq crisis. Do you think that this, in fact, is a path that should have been much more actively explored?
Well, I think it should have been, and I think it still can be more actively explored by our governmental leaders. Again, I believe this is precisely what the Holy See has been saying. In fact, Syria has a good percentage of these refugees, and if the United States is going to play a factor in providing humanitarian relief to these refugees within Syria's borders, I think more conversation has to be open between Syria and the United States. And the same with Iran, just because of the crisis over the potential of Iran achieving a nuclear weapon.
You also recently urged the U.S. government not to consider engaging in military action in Iran until all other options are exhausted. Are you personally worried that the U.S. could be sliding little by little towards an armed confrontation with Tehran over that country's nuclear program?
Well, I would hope not, but there certainly has been some saber rattling in recent weeks, and I don't think that is very helpful, because we don't want to have the saber rattling to force both sides into positions that they really would not be able to back away from. Again, I think what we've been saying as a bishops' conference is completely in line with what the Holy See has been saying and what our tradition of Catholic teachings have been, that military options should always be the last resort and all other means of engagement should be exhausted first. I think the possibility of Iran arming itself with a nuclear weapon is certainly a legitimate concern, and it would certainly be a irritant in the balance of power in that region. But we had a similar issue with North Korea, and in the past several months, it seems that with North Korea, there has been some negotiations, and I believe the crisis with North Korea at the present time has been largely diffused because of conversations, because of negotiations, because of dialogue. And so I think before we rattle sabers and threaten preemptive strikes on Iran, we should exhaust those same means that were used diplomatically with North Korea.
Could, in fact, an eventual military strike against Tehran, in your view, risk inflaming further the Middle East and maybe even boosting the chance of mass terrorist attacks?
Well, I'm not a fortune teller, and I cannot predict the future, but that would certainly be a very sad future if that in fact came about. I think one of the things that is very important right now in the Middle East is the soon-to-be re-engaged talks between Palestine and Israel. And those negotiations will take place soon at Annapolis in Maryland. And I believe a successful conclusion to the conflict between the Palestinian Authority and Israel would certainly help enhance the chances of peace throughout the region. And so, again, I think that's very important that our political leaders make a two-state solution to the crisis in the Palestinian-Israeli crisis a high priority at this time. And I think a successful solution of that conflict, where Palestine becomes an independent state with defendable borders and that Israel's security is guaranteed, I think that would help drain the swamp of terrorism to a great degree in that region.
Coming back just briefly, though, to the dispute over Tehran's nuclear program, the bishops did say that the U.S. experience in Iraq has taught that the use of force can have unintended consequences.
And that is certainly true, and that's true of any conflict. And we will be dealing with the unintended consequences of our entry into Iraq for many years to come. And that's the challenge that we have right now, is how do we exit responsibly? What is a responsible transition, and what should it look like? So again, you know, I'm reminded of the words of John Paul II previous to the invasion of Iraq, where he emphasized so strongly and so prophetically that war always represents a defeat for humanity. And so we need victories, but not military victories, but victories of negotiations, of diplomacy, of political process.
Changing the subject a bit, did the bishops discuss at length Pope Benedict's upcoming visit to the USA?
Well, we didn't discuss it too much, but we were very happy to be informed of the Pope's plans, and that was done by the Apostolic Nuncio and his address to the bishops on Monday morning. And so we were very pleased to hear that Pope Benedict will be coming to the United States in April of 2008. Again, he'll be here, and he'll be meeting with the bishops of the United States, and so that will be a great opportunity for the bishops as a body to express their affection and their loyalty to the Holy Father. Again, he's coming on a rather limited visit.
What impact do you think this papal visit will have both on the U.S. Church and the faithful at large, and what sort of benefit do you think they will both gain from it?
Well, I think one impact will be, of course, that the Pope will be on our shores, and he will be speaking to the American people, to the Catholic community of the United States on several occasions at special masses. And those are all great opportunities for catechesis and for evangelization. And so I think that the fact that he's being here will give him a forum to speak with American Catholics, but Americans of all religious persuasions. And we know how engaging he is when he speaks and how he expresses very profound truths in a very simple and engaging manner. And so I think this will be a very positive visit and have a very positive impact on advancing the Church's mission here in the United States.
Bishop Thomas Wenske of Orlando, Florida, there speaking to Susie Hodges. Thank you.
Enhancing Interfaith Dialogue for Better Intercultural Relationships and Peace. That's the theme of a seminar in Rome this week, organized by the embassies of Australia and Indonesia to the Holy See. Panelists were examining the challenges facing relations between Muslims and Christians in the Asia-Pacific region and included representatives from the Vatican, Christian churches in Australia, and from the Catholic Church and the Muslim communities in Indonesia. Well, this week, Pope Benedict received in audience Indonesia's new ambassador to the Holy See, Mr. Suprapto Martusitomo, and praised Indonesia's efforts to promote good relations between Christians and Muslims in the world's most populous Muslim nation. Well, I spoke to Mr. Andri Hadi, Director General for Public Diplomacy and Information at Indonesia's Department of Foreign Affairs, who gave one of the opening speeches at the seminar. I asked him why Indonesia felt the need for such a conference and what importance does his country's government place on interfaith dialogue.
Our government is very active in promoting interfaith dialogue. For example, in 2004, with the government of Australia, we hosted the Interfaith Dialogue for Asia-Pacific region, and then followed by Cebu Conference and Waitangi. And also our government had several bilateral interfaith dialogue with Canada, with Australia, and with Vatican and Netherlands. So our government strongly believes that through dialogue, we can increase our understanding about our religion or our faith because, we have to be frank that there is still misunderstanding, there is still prejudice, there is still misperception about this issue. Then our government believes that through dialogue, we could reduce this misperception and other misunderstanding.
Now, Indonesia is the most populous Muslim country, but there is a small Christian minority in Indonesia. How are the relations between these two different communities?
The relation is very good. Although we are majority of Indonesia are Muslim, but based on our constitution, we protect all minority, Christian minority, Buddhist, Hindu. So, sometimes there is misunderstanding on the grounds, but definitely, overall, we have very excellent relationship between faith in Indonesia.
And your relations with the Vatican and the Holy See?
It's great. It's very good. I think we have very good relation with your ambassador there. And then also our embassy here is working very hard to increase our understanding. And then we have more than 700 pastor and sister here in Vatican. So I think we really great relationship with the Holy See.
I'm very pleased to hear that.
Yeah.
Now, in receiving Indonesia's new ambassador to the Holy See, Pope Benedict praised your country's efforts to promote relations between the different religions. And he said that terrorism was a major threat to Indonesia's idea of national unity. What steps is your government taking to prevent the spread of terrorism, both within and without your country?
Well, if we see the situation in Indonesia, we are maybe a country that very successful in tracking terrorism. We are the victim of terrorism, for example, in Bali and then in Jakarta. However, as of as today, our enforcement, our police, our enforcement law agency, you know, has successfully bring all the terrorists or their colleagues to the court and then to the trial. So, and then more than 200 terrorists affiliated is on trial, and then we are one of the country that has been praised by other country in tracking terrorism. So I think Indonesia is the best example how to deal with terrorists because we deal them with based on the law and regulation. And that's one thing. And then the second one is the root cause of people. Many people think that, you know, terrorism is not only action of violence. Sometimes we have to talk with other country, for example, with you know, many, many countries that in preventing terrorism, we cannot do by ourselves. We have to work together in the region, regionally and internationally.
Now, Central Sulawesi, which has a large number of Christians, has seen some terrible violence over the past years with assassinations, the closure of some churches, bombings and so on. Much of it has been blamed on Muslim extremist groups that appear to want to get rid of the Christians in that region. What action has the government been taking to protect Christians from this sort of violence and to promote reconciliation between Muslims and Christians in areas such as this where tensions have been very high?
Yes, tension, you are right, tension is high in that area. But the most important thing is this is not religious motive violence. It's mostly closely related with the, you know, the political and then the economic issue, not a religious issue. And then, well, we take some strong measure, even to the Muslim fundamentalists or to other also. But in addition to taking strong measure to them, we also facilitate reconciliation. I think now the situation is getting better in Poso. The government working together with the religious leader from Muslim and then from Christian, we sit together, we facilitate them to increase their mutual understanding. And I think as of today, the situation is peaceful there, very good progress in that area.
Well, so this is sounds like a grassroots effort in a certain sense.
Definitely, yes. Because we strongly believe, you know, religious leader has a very important role in promoting peaceful in that area. And then the government, the law enforcement, you know, give them big or more space to have dialogue between them.
One last question. In the conference, it came up that in many parts of the world, Muslims associate Christians with the West. However, as we see in the Asia-Pacific region, there are many Christians there as well.
You're right. But to tell you frankly, I mean, we cannot associate Christian with the West because we have many Christians in the East. That's the most important thing. The Christian is in the West. The Christian is in the East. So we cannot divide, you know, Christian coming from the West or Christian coming from the East.
Mr. Andri Hadi, Director General for Public Diplomacy and Information at Indonesia's Department of Foreign Affairs. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.